welcome to Network Capital. We are so delighted to have you with us. I've long admired the work that Renew and Renew Foundation does. And I've personally been trying to understand your career and what led you here. So I think it'll be awesome if you could just tell us a bit about your early life and what led you to, you know, founding this impactful organization.
Great. No, it's an absolute pleasure to be here on this chat with you. And, you know, like most careers, when we look back, you know, they seem, I guess, very planned and, you know, kind of purposeful from day one. But mine is a regular journey where I would say when I look back, it adds up in interesting ways. But I was, you know, just a young, I would say, you know, student who wanted to, you know, go to a good university. And then from a good university, I had plans to study international relations. And I wanted to then again go to a good university, not only in India, but internationally. And then get a good job, like all of us like to when you're in a good university. And it all keeps getting more and more competitive. And perhaps that's what makes you a harder seeker and gets you to keep working towards your goal in a more structured and a more focused way. And along the journey, you identify sometimes new areas to do, to get engaged in, or to continue doing what you've always wanted to do better and in a more focused way. So I think mine was a bit of a combination of all of these. At a young age, I was interested in sustainability. And now when I speak, I am chairing the sustainability function. I serve on the boards which relate to sustainability. So it looks like I planned it since I was a young girl. And that sounds like a good story. But honestly, not really. I was a member of the People's Environment Group when I was in Hindu College in Delhi University. And it inspired me. I met a lot of people who were doing inspiring work and led lives I had dreamt to lead, but they were not in places like New York, London, and New Delhi, but they were in places like Shahdol in Madhya Pradesh, where I thought that was the most romantic career one could pursue, where you pursued what you wanted to do, where you wanted to have an impact, and you actually felt the change you wanted to bring about. But as I moved along, that was not meant to be. You know, I joined the banking. I wanted to join the World Bank, international financial institutions, development finance, or the UN. Those were my top choices when I was studying at Columbia University on a scholarship. And I honestly went and did some work there. But I realized earlier on that it was perhaps smarter of me to get a job on Wall Street and then marry what I wanted to do, which is work in the emerging markets and also have financial independence and security to be able to pursue my interests at a later point in time. So that's what I decided when I was in my, I would say, mid to early 20s. After that, I pursued a career in investment banking for about 15 years. And I must say that I was lucky to have worked in cities like London and New York and, you know, investment banking and corporate America in the M&A, international business development field. I headed a Japanese investment bank in India, did one of the most, I would say, marquee deals, like a Euro-Yen transaction for institutions like IRFC and Exim Bank. So it was really great experience. And then Renew happened in 2010, where Sumant, who is my husband, decided to start this venture. And honestly, I was not signing up for it because it didn't seem very exciting to me at that point in time. But I got pulled into it because we needed people to get to work and, you know, raise funds and just do a lot of stuff to build an organization. And, you know, we got funded earlier on, which perhaps, you know, locked me in this area. And happily so, when I look back, that I'm glad I made that decision to work and contribute to the Renew journey. Because as we look back, it's really been the most amazing experience, an experience which has been one of learning and continues to be an experience and journey of learning every day. Because there's so much to be done in this area. So I'll pause here for a second. Just wanted to kind of take you through how I got to where I am as we speak today.
This is very helpful. And the reason I asked you to give a sort of expansive introduction is because we're a mentorship and a career transition platform, and you've undertaken quite a few. You went from Hindu to Columbia straight out of college. Then you explored various jobs like World Bank, United Nations, which a lot of our community members do. And then eventually you did 15 years in banking, then helped start one of the most iconic companies. So there has been quite a lot. And I don't think there was a grand plan up front, which is often the case. And you figured it out as life went along. So talk to us about your recent conversation at Columbia. I believe you were at the Columbia Business School, I would say India Forum, or a forum of sorts, or maybe it was a SIPA forum. You talked about the role of youth in trying to shape the climate narrative. Or what did you mean by that? And how have you tried to figure out that question?
No, sure, absolutely. You know, I think it's really encouraging to see the amount of interest and enthusiasm students across the world, you know, India, the IIMs here, when we go to campus to recruit young women who, you know, we go to some of the women's institutions here. Internationally, we speak to students from around the world. We have our own Global Green Scholars Program, where we invite students on a selective basis to come and do an internship at Renew. It's a very selective process. And, you know, we've got a scholarship. And now other universities like University of Chicago, Princeton, some of the best universities in the world, provide a scholarship for students to come and work at Renew. So we have that MOU in place. And when I meet students who are in graduate programs, whether an MBA or a public policy program, there is a sense of urgency they have. And it's not only driven by aspirations for their professions and careers, but it's really driven by their concern for what's going to happen to their future. And often when we have ambitions which are driven by purpose, we tend to be more serious about those ambitions and, you know, put in more effort. And I've been seeing that, you know, whether it is in finance, whether it is in strategy, you know, consulting, you know, the world is going through a huge amount of churn with respect to the priorities institutions are giving to sectors. It's not as much as it IT and FMCG now as it is really sustainability. When you look at companies like McKinsey, etc., I don't think they've ever had such high budgets to invest in this area. And why are they investing in this area? Because companies like ours, companies who are in hard to abate, they really all need to come up with a strategy to transition, a strategy towards net zero, which means there's a huge amount of opportunity for young people to position themselves and, of course, address the purpose which they have in life and also be able to make money. So one is, as what is it that you can go and do if you want to work in an organization? But not everybody wants to work in a multinational or, you know, a large organization or in a corporate. Many people want to start up their own ventures. And it's really interesting to see. The other day, I was in conversation with a very young student from Stanford who, barely out of his undergrad program, had already raised funds to be able to start a venture in AI. So a lot of young students really want to go and start up their own ventures, and they're really hungry to know what are the areas they can get into. So at Columbia, and I was also speaking at Harvard, at both of these platforms, I talked about the opportunity which is there, which is in now what we call the traditional renewable energy space, right? Whether it is, you know, wind power, you know, IPP, you know, solar manufacturing, hydro, and all of these areas, which are now conventional renewables, but also new and upcoming areas like pumped hydro, green hydrogen, nature-based solutions, carbon credits, and the list is long, carbon sequestration. And these are all areas which seem to be technical, but they are not as technical as they sound. It's basically just trying to understand a particular problem and then working in a very diligent way with a business plan, identifying the weaknesses, the opportunities, obviously doing the more most important thing, communicating your business plan properly to investors. And the good news is, at this time, when we are talking, the amount of interest there is amongst financial investors in this area has been unprecedented. So it's time for us to be able to leverage that. And I think people are investing in young talent. You know, I was just at a session where we were talking about women leadership, and I was saying there as well that, you know, it's never been a better time to be a woman than it is now. And similarly, it's never been a better time to be young entrepreneurs as it is now, because, and especially when students, I'm sure, who are on your call today are all talented and trained students who want to go out and make a difference. So I'll pause here for a second.
Yeah.
There are a lot of opportunities in traditional areas, you know, strategy, HR, finance, but just setting up a business in specific areas, it's just the list is long, and you just need people to be able to go and, you know, just take a little bit of risk and just go and do it.
Yeah. We recorded asynchronously. So about 100,000 plus people will listen to it in a couple of days. But we have a couple of people who we've just invited who wanted to ask you specific questions, largely about what you spoke about. So Vaishali, you spoke about the huge shift and the culture at Renew. I can tell you scores of Network Capital people have worked and do work at Renew. So we have a hands-on perspective of what it feels like to work there. Lots of Schwarzman scholars, people from Stanford and other leading universities have worked their internships, jobs, and so forth. And they speak very fondly of seeing a mission-driven organization. But I strongly feel that mission-driven organizations are built up front. So what were the first 100, 200 days like when the company was getting started? What were the conversations in the room? What was the larger problem that you all were thinking about, and has that evolved over the years?
Yeah, evolved like what? Significantly so. The first few, you know, sometimes what happens is it's very difficult to even track back as to when did you actually start? Because when you're starting, you don't really know whether you're going to start or not, and things happen, and one thing leads to another. But if I were to pinpoint, I think it is, you know, I think we started at least a year and a half before our official capital raising happened, where we signed the deal. And the days, so let me just focus on perhaps the few months ahead of that. You know, we had, I think the most important thing is for people to believe in your idea. Yeah. And I think people who believe in your idea are the ones who are the real champions. Of course, people who have the idea are champions. Needless to say, that is a fact. But people who then believe your idea, because you don't have much to show at that time, are the ones who are really, they're the ones who make you leaders. Yeah. So a lot of respect for them. And they, I guess, had also these jobs with fat salaries to come onus on you to really get things right, because there's a huge sense of responsibility to the people who've joined you and supported you. The other sort of vibe at that time was that people didn't, there weren't, it's not easy to hire people. Now at Renew, we can hire people, you know, sometimes they're expensive, they may not work out. But at that time, you know, you're using a lot of than me. They were really, you know, we were professionals. So it was our savings, we said, that we're going to go and do this, right? So a lot of it was trying to get the best resource, most cost-effective resource, and then try and do a zillion things to be able to meet the criteria which we had set for investors for our business plan and move the needle ahead. So I think just getting the right people was a challenge. And then we were getting into an area where you know, nobody really knew what we were talking about. So to us, intuitively, counterintuitively, that was a great area to get in. It was an area people hadn't heard.
A blue ocean,
about,
exactly.
Yeah. Right. So time hadn't come, but then it was for us to try and see how we could do it, because it wasn't like there was a huge talent pool there with experience who we could just invite, as is the case now, where you can just get people to work for you from one company to the other. It wasn't the case then. So I would say these were the sort of, I think we were very confident, and definitely I would say more so Sumant about the business plan, what he wanted to do. But, you know, we'd all worked in offices, like, you know, in investment banks, and going to back beyond India in the sites and, you know, getting the whole infra game to start rolling was quite challenging as well. And so we are very grateful to the people who came on, took it up, supported us, and we got our first, you know, wind farm started in about, I think it was 2012-13, where we started our first 25 megawatts in Jharkhand. And as we speak now, you know, we are talking about delivering 50 gigawatts for the country year on year. We do 2 gigawatts approximately year on year. So that's the shift in scale which has happened. And at that time, the government was talking about setting up another 20 gigawatts by 2020. And this is 2010. Right. Right, so another 20 gigawatts in 10 years. And now we're talking about a 50 gigawatts year on year. So that's the transition and transformation in the pace and the scale of what is to be done in this area.
And I think this shows how much the country has progressed and, of course, how large ReNew has become. I wanted to ask, how has the attitude of different stakeholders changed? The government, civil society, young professionals you talked about in your previous answer, and then the people that you actually serve on the ground when you build your site, set up infrastructure. What's the palpable shift, if any, you've observed over the last 14 years?
You know, it's really black and white. You know, as I said, when you started, everybody, you know, if you look at the corporates, if you look at even the government, you know, the world was really about, you know, using, you know, the tax benefits associated with erecting a turbine and whatever else revolved around it. This whole idea of an IPP didn't exist. So just the education associated with it was tremendous. And I think that itself was a very interesting experience. And I must commend our government for being very committed to this area. And as we know, this makes a difference. You know, we see other countries where if the leadership at the top is not committed to building this area, you can have a lot of debates and very limited action. But in our country, as far as renewables is concerned and setting up renewables, there were very few debates. There was just action. There was action. There was interaction with industry and the policymakers. There were listening sessions. People were getting to work. And I think India has done the most incredible job with respect to building this sector step by step, you know, tweaking policies to make sure that, you know, people like us can go and execute for the sector. We were very committed to executing for the sector and not for ourselves only. It sounds a little bit, we're obviously committed to setting up these farms for ourselves, but there was a broader purpose because if the entire ecosystem developed, we could grow as well, right? And so therefore, I think that's been fantastic. The whole industry policymaker interaction has been great. We've seen good, healthy competition, international and domestic, which is always great for a sector to have. And so we've never been really intimidated by it. We welcome it. We learn from each other and we learn to focus and do what we can do best. So I think that's also really been good. As far as hiring in the sector is concerned, it's always, I think people is the toughest sort of equation to solve for, to get the best people. Sometimes you get a lot of people, then you want to have, you know, from the large pool, it's tougher to find out who are the good people. So that game continues. But I think Renewal actually ended up becoming a nursery for recruitment for the larger industry because, you know, we've been in the space since the beginning. So we were actually training the pool and then serving the sector with this pool in a way. So we kind of learned to try and do better there so that we could retain the best with us. I believe, you know, we have some of our best resources still remain with us. So obviously you end up losing a few, but then that is business as it is. So, and as far as people on the ground is what you were asking are concerned, you know, I think now the sort of demand around having how we set up these farms has become very important. So this whole ESG kind of narrative around how are you doing this? Are you responsible from an environment, social, governance point of view, and safety and inclusivity? And I think that's been fantastic for us to be able to do what we are doing just in a better way, in a more comprehensive way. And that's where I come in because, you know, I chair the sustainability function in this organization. So the job really is not only to do things in a certain way, but to ensure each of the business head is committed to this. And that itself is quite a task, actually, because as you know, in yeah. business, we all want to improve the bottom line. And sometimes it's just short term. So getting them to look at the long-term benefits and all of these things as an investment, I must say, has been challenging, but we've got a lot of cooperation because, you know, it's not a choice anymore. Investors are asking for it. Regulators are asking for it. So it's a must do. So hence it becomes easy.
I will say that it seems like there's also been a resurgence of national confidence for some reason between 2010 and 2024. That can be attributed to all the factors that you mentioned. It's policy interaction, action on the ground, the overall growth of the economic pie. So I think there is some research work done on what happens when countries grow, how do they take the industries and people along with them. You mentioned ESG. There is a lot of optimism about ESG and a fair amount of skepticism. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, there are always two sides of the coin.
Yeah. So when you look at the overall picture, where do you think that skepticism comes from, and what's your perspective? Are you still optimistic about the future of using ESG as an integral part of doing business, or do you think that there's some legitimacy to the critique?
See. You know, I would say that ESG has been a very important part of the evolution of, I would say, the way corporates do business. I think it's important to do business with a purpose. I think it's important for us to give back what we have. But then, you know, ESG really is, you know, it's just about doing business in a certain way, which I don't think you can debate whether you have to be environmentally conscious. Of course you do. You know, do you need to meet your 2030 goals? Of course we do. Do we need to preserve the earth for the next generation, the generations after? Of course you need to. But then what we really have to, you know, to be able to keep the critiques a little bit, I would say, silent, is to ensure that we can measure what we are doing and report what we are doing systematically. And to the extent we can do that, I think it's good for business. You know, all of what we are doing is not only good for the society at large, it's also good for business. And, investors are asking for it, regulators are asking for it. There's sometimes, I think, narratives which come up, which perhaps sometimes are driven by, say, you know, corporates from a certain segment, maybe, who knows, I don't know, maybe by certain investors based on what their portfolio looks like. But I just feel that this journey is now, it has taken off. And most people, especially in Europe, if you see the amount of funds which are pouring into this area, are just, I would say proof that this is not something which is nice to do. I think everybody is committed and they mean business. When we talk about ESG, we know at Renew, we are a renewable energy company. And, we are offsetting about just a little under 2%, 1% of India's carbon emissions. But our investors are concerned about how we do business. Do we follow safe practices? Do we have a good governance system? Are we inclusive? Do we have a certain percentage of women on board, et cetera, et cetera? So I feel that, yeah, there might be hiccups, but world at large agrees that that countries, not only companies, need to have certain goals and milestones which go beyond profitability, but are really sort of centered around you know, environment and social impact as well.
Yeah, I love what you said about the importance of measurement, because that is critical if we want to take these measures seriously and make them part of a business practice. I also agree with your earlier point that the role of young professionals and youth movements in making ESG front and center, putting pressure on different stakeholders, has now reached its tipping point. People are now, you know, across the board, there's a survey that millennials, Gen Zs, have a preference for brands that are more sustainable. So business practice, government policies, youth sentiment, and of course, measurement, I think collectively creates more of a buzz around the term. Earlier, Vaishali, you talked about the gender-centric lens, and this is something that you've championed in various forums of industry and academia. Tell us what that means on a day-to-day basis, and how do you see that work at Renew and Renew Foundation?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And, you know, the work around gender, it's at a certain level, it's very personal. And at a certain level, it's entirely professional as well. I would say entirely, but quite professional. I do believe that, you know, times have changed. I think women, we've always seen are outperformers when they are in high school, etc. When we move ahead in life, they continue to do well. But unfortunately, there is some leakage when we see women in STEM drop down, because, you know, most of these engineering institutions or, you know, science institutions or, you know, medical institutions are in remote areas. And then families step in and then, you know, they prevent girls from going there. And so then there is some leakage there. Well, some of them continue and, you know, finish college, go to, you know, kind of go and get jobs, etc. Then there's a leakage once there is, you know, when they get married, they have children, then there's a growing demand. And it's quite painful to see that, because I see how hard we work to get into these very competitive areas. I see my daughter, who's quite, you know, she's quite a firebrand, like most of your young participants here are. They work very hard to compete and get the best jobs, get into the best institutions, and for them to just fall off because of inherent biases, etc., requires people to, you know, kind of do more. Like, you know, my daughter often says that, you know, we were in New York, both Sumanth and I used to work there, and she often tells us that, well, if you would have sort of gotten up and said more, then perhaps it makes it easier for, you know, people in the next generation to go and rise and so on and so forth. And so there is an expectation that we must do more. Our generation must do more. I feel that I want to get more women engaged, because it's good for the workplace to have more women. They are bright, they are brilliant, and I've seen them perform exceedingly well. So why should we not ensure that any of these biases which exist at the workplace are removed? So from that point of view, whatever I can do is less. And I'm very happy to participate. So right now, I was on a session with Minister Irani, where she'd commissioned a report to identify the gap areas for women to take leadership roles. So, you know, very simple activity, yeah, but important, hopefully, for the sector as well. So when the top leadership gets engaged, and then we can cascade it to leaders within industry and further to, you know, to work with them to perhaps change policies, like, you know, we have just one woman on board as a requirement. Can we increase that to ensure we have more women on board? So how do we do that? How do we make it possible by partnering and working with the government. Of course, we want government to stay out of business, but we need their sort of support to be able to come up with enabling policies. Then at work, you know, what we do around our ESG also, you know, a lot of the funds we get, like the loans, etc., from multilateral institutions, actually have a requirement that we need to ensure that our sites are inclusive. We have a certain percentage of women working on our sites, etc. And similarly on safety and various other issues. So, you know, I just work to make sure that we are doing what we have to do and do a little bit more. I'm also working on projects which go a little bit outside of what I must do, but which is nice to do. So for things like I see in our sector, there are very few women. We need to put up so many megawatts, right? 500 gigawatts in the next few years, 50 gigawatts year on year. We are at 180 odd gigawatts now in about, say, 14 to 15 years. That's what we've got to. Now we need to triple this in one third of the time. Those are the targets we need to meet. And often people say there's not enough people out there who can work, the kind of problems we were having when we started, right? Not enough workforce out there. But there are women out there in rural areas who are actually mentally very independent. They've been used to working. And so can we, and some of them are engaged in areas which are not necessarily the most, I would say, friendly areas to work in, like salt pan farming, etc. So we have projects like Project Surya, which is again a partnership with organizations like the United Nations and some of the other industries, where we are bringing women together, skilling them, training them, and preparing them to become technicians. So that's great. But then what we need to do is to ensure that they can work, and they can work comfortably. We need to have an infrastructure, which is an enabling infrastructure for them. Basic things like a toilet. It sounds like a very basic thing. There are no toilets. How can you operate without a toilet anywhere? I mean, think about it. If men had to go to work and there wasn't a toilet, it's highly inconvenient. I mean, it could dissuade you from going to work the next day, right? So similarly, women need just basic facilities, infrastructure, hostels, safe working environment, security, etc. Because we need to make sure men get used to having women at the workplace. It's not a problem which women have. Men have a problem. They're not used to seeing women at the workplace in certain areas. And we need to be able to ensure they understand what it means to work with women, the respect, the fairness, and the commitment, the allyship, and the sponsorship which is required. The onus really lies on men to do a lot more as well.
Absolutely. Thankfully, in Network Capital, we have equal number of men and women. And through our partnerships, through our the conversations that we hold with international leaders and leaders within the country, we try and make sure that this point is not lost. Ms. Irani was also on Network Capital, so she touched upon something very similar. And we try and invite people from all political spectrums, from all backgrounds in business and otherwise. And this is front and center of what we do, because it's good business, and it's very important to make that part of the conversation. Specifically in the work that you do with Renew Foundation, do you want to tell me some stories that have helped you develop an understanding of the sector that you didn't think was possible early on? Do you want to tell us a few stories about why does it exist? Is it CSR only? Is it CSR and something else? Talk to us about your vision, the architecture of the foundation.
Sure. No, absolutely. See, if you want, so let me back up. Of course, there is some amount of it is CSR, but what we, you know, we've been doing CSR for the last decade, and, you know, CSR has its own limitations. You can work in your area. There's limitation in the kind of partners you can work with, how you can work with the government, so on and so forth. And so as we grew our CSR work, there was need for us to be able to scale projects. And for scaling, we had to be able to strike certain types of partnership. And that is what led to the birth of Renew Foundation. And we wanted to do have an impact in the sector, because there were a lot of demands which the sector was placing for us to do a lot more, whether it was around skilling, whether it was around educating the youth, whether it was about engaging women, whether it was just doing programs which made people understand that climate change is for real. For example, we have a very small program, which was actually recognized by the president of India as a good program. And, you know, it's a very small thing, but it gave us a lot of joy and encouragement. It's a small program, which we actually started as an employee engagement program, which is gift warm, gifting warm. Right. So it's about taking in the, you know, in the dead of winter, a renewer takes a blanket, which Renew gives to them. And then they go and give it to somebody on the streets who needs it more than them. So that was a very simple philosophy that, you know, why don't we? And what was happening is we were seeing temperatures just sort of, you know, become quite volatile. Sometimes it was colder than expected. Sometimes it was, you know, just unexpected rain. You know, we've had like more than 100 climate events this year than we've seen in the past 100 years. So there's a lot of data around there, which shows that there's a lot happening in climate change. And so therefore, we had to be mindful about it. But people didn't really understand this. So when we spoke to people who lived in, you know, states like Odisha and Rajasthan and various other states where a lot of these climate events happen, you ask them if they were impacted by climate change. The answer was no, not really, not at all. Everything's great here. Then you ask them specific questions around, oh, does it rain here? Do you have floods here? Has there been a drought here, et cetera, et cetera? And the answer to that was, yes, of course. My grandmother passed away. My aunt got whatever, you know, ill and then passed away. We've relocated 10 times because of this, et cetera, et cetera. So we figured that there is need to create awareness. So this was a small way to do that. But now as we speak, most of this program, it's a part of the foundation. We have various other partners who contribute to this program. And so it's become, we've been able to scale it and get many others engaged, which we could not have done if it was only an in-house CSR program. So that's how the foundation came into being. And as we speak now we are looking at training hundreds and thousands of young climate leaders of in climate education. So we have a curriculum which is in 3 or 4 vernaculars. And the whole idea is to get young children in school, in high school, to just basically understand what climate change is, what is the science behind it, what are the opportunities they can look at, and so on and so forth. So we run programs like this, which go beyond just Renew working on a project, which relates to our project in a particular site, because that's how CSR is done. You know, you have an entity, and then you do some business and you do 2% of that goes for a CSR project. But what we are doing is we're doing strategic work, which can be cannot be limited to the CSR. It goes beyond that. It's more for the sector, more around climate change, more to do with youth and women, and in partnerships and, you know, aligning with some of the programs which the government is also sort of advocating for. So it's just larger, more strategic, more scalable.
That's fantastic. I'm going to ask you to look forward now. So imagine 10 years from now or 20 years from now, if Renew has become even larger than it is, you are achieving a lot of your goals. How do you see the industry changing? Like, what's the largest shift that you want to bring in the country, the industry, and on the people you serve? Here, I'd like you to think very boldly, because one important skill we want to teach all our listeners, all our stakeholders, is the art of prospecting. So I'd love for you to try and imagine and give us your story there.
Sure, I think it's very simple. I just want to, first of all, see more than 50% women in the sector, just metrics, just more than 50% in the sector, whether it's business, whether it's on the ground site, et cetera, engagement, which is, you know, across not only renewables, but the whole decarbonization spectrum and the transition spectrum. Can we get more women in this sector? Because I think it's critical women understand what climate change is, because they are at the receiving end of this. So they really need to get engaged and they must get engaged at the leadership level. I think I want to see a lot more private sector engagement. I want them to take a lot more action. As we speak now, I think less than 20% of the top housing companies in the world even have SBTi goals. So that's not enough. I want to see a world where the business is really driving this transition and there is a lot less greenwashing than what we see around us right now. And so, and I think the last but not the least, fourth industrial revolution is going to make enable us to do a lot more with a lot less in a greener way. So, which means that lot less funds spent, but more scalability, and to do all of this more sustainably. So I think that's the landscape going to be. I hope we can see, you know, as I said, more women, you know, less carbon footprint to be able to transition.
Fantastic. Is there anything I should have asked you that I didn't, or any parting words of advice to our audience, which is Indian and a lot of them who live outside India?
I mean, nothing really. It was a great set of questions, you know, you put to me. I really enjoyed this conversation. I just feel that this group is really, you know, one of the most dynamic set of youngsters. I believe they are probably in their 20s and, you know, 30s. And, you know, the world is their oasis. You know, it's just not working in a certain geography. You know, it's just the world. We can just choose to get up and go and work and live anywhere we want to. That's a real privilege. So therefore, I would say that for them, life should be a continuous learning journey. And I think that's what makes life enriching, purposeful. And so all I want to say is just go and do your bit, because we would love to see what you can do and make sure it is much better than what we've been able to do.
Fantastic. And lastly, is there anything you've changed your mind on working on this sector, working on this problem for a while? And if yes, what is it? And if not, that's fine as well.
You know, well, the one thing which I just feel is that, you know, there are lots of new things we have to do in this sector. And so we shouldn't hesitate to take that step forward, take that risk. And sometimes you may be right, and hopefully most of the times you'll be right. But when you're wrong and things don't work out the way they should, we should just go forward with double the energy, because I think that's the sort of energy which is required. And so, yeah, I think that's what's required, because often not everything works out for what you want. And we should be confident about what we're doing and not second guess what we did and why we did what we did.
I agree. Well, thank you very much, Vaishali, for this wide-ranging conversations about policy, about your own career, and the broader vision of the company and the foundation. I think the optimism and the energy and the clarity that you have will resonate with all of our listeners. I truly appreciate your time.
Thanks, Utkarsh, and all the best. It's some good stuff you're doing, and keep going.
Yes.
I really